Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nucleus Investment Insights. Our attention turns this week to the continuing saga unfurling between China and Australia and its ability to now leverage iron ore in the battle. 7 months ago, we took a look at the beginning of its oust with Australia. News came out in early November 2020 that China had ordered traders to stop purchasing at least seven categories of Australian commodities, including coal, barley, copper ore and concentrate, sugar, timber, wine and lobster, ratcheting up tensions in what was at the time its most sweeping retaliation yet. Not long after, Australia signed off on a landmark defence deal with Japan, taking the next step toward building a coalition of like-minded democracies, pushing back against what they view as Beijing's increasing expansionism in the Indo-Pacific. In March this year, China has imposed tariffs of up to 218% on Australian wine for 5 years, formalising curbs that have been in place for months, alongside an increasingly fraught relationship with Canberra. And you can be sure it will not end there. As the behemoth in demand of global commodities, it makes a lot of sense to consider China's real influence in both global and local markets, and it seems ours is squarely in the crosshairs. News out this week saw the Chinese National Food and Strategic Reserves Administration declaring that they will release state stockpiles of metals, including copper, aluminium and zinc, which brought down iron ore prices and caused havoc with global miners. We may very well be seeing the next strike in the ongoing trade war. Joining us today for his views on the emerging iron ore dilemma is our chief strategist, David Llewellyn-Smith. Hello to you, David.
G'day, Tim. Good to be here.
Good to have you on. And also here to share his thoughts on how we reflect these ideas today in our portfolios, we have our head of investments, Damien Klassen. Hello to you, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
Good to have you on as well. Just a quick reminder that before we get started, if you haven't already, subscribe and click on the notification bell to be notified of when we go live or have a new webinar to watch, or follow us on your preferred podcast platform. And we also ask if you'd like to take a moment to click like on the video now to help our show grow. And of course, as always, for those listening in live, feel free to drop in your questions in the YouTube live stream chat to have them answered along the way. So let's jump into it, gents. So we've got our agenda for today. So we're going to be looking at friends into frenemies into enemies. We'll then be taking a focus, as we've mentioned, on the iron ore side of things. So we're looking at iron ore market cycles, the iron ore market structure, and then, of course, rolling it up and wrapping it up, as we always do, into investment implications and how we use these themes here every day at Nucleus Wealth. So we'll kick off. Dave, I believe you said you wanted to get started on the idea of friends, friendlies to enemies.
Yeah, well, I guess the key there is we used to be friends. We're currently frenemies, Australia and China, that is, on our way to being enemies. This is the basic trajectory of this geopolitical relationship. And the reason I say that with confidence is I think that the drivers of the breaking down of friendship are structural, not cyclical or diplomatic, as some parties, including the federal opposition in Australia, have suggested. This is basically a problem born of differing political systems. And we saw, you know, a little bit of history, I guess, from, you know, around the turn of the millennium, as China ramped up its urbanisation growth model, put a great deal of effort into making friends with Australia, and, of course, invested very heavily in various commodity areas, especially iron ore, but not only iron ore. Sure. And that sort of first phase of friendship, if you like, was very successful, transpired from around the millennium through to about 2011. Post GFC, when the last great commodities bust transpired, and you know, then we saw a huge bust in Australia's commodity values for a couple of years, and as a result, the Australian dollar fell away very heavily, and you know, down from sort of 110 all the way down to the, I guess, mid to high 60s. And what that did was restructure the kind of economic relationship that we were having with China. Like from around, say, 2013 onwards, instead of us growing our mineral exports to China, we started growing services exports, higher education, immigration, investment into real estate, tourism, etc. A lot of foodstuffs.
Milk powder.
Milk powder, like all the goodies.
Wine,
as they said at the time. I think, what was it? It was from the mining to the dining boom. And that went fine for a couple of years. But as we started to note relatively early on in that boom, it was starting to, you know, almost immediately actually started to bring with it all sorts of political economy tensions. Because in effect, what was happening was, rather than us export stuff to China, we were importing both Chinese peoples and Chinese capital. And so what in effect we were importing was influence from China. That was coming part and parcel with this second phase of engagement. And it took a few years for that influence to manifest itself publicly in ways that unsettled the political economy. But then by 2015, I think it was, we ended up with the Sam Dastyari affair. Mm. Might have been 2016. Anyway, around there, where it became apparent that certain Chinese influences, very likely linked to the CCP, were starting to buy the views of Australian politicians. It was already, the same kind of forces were already very active in our universities, starting to distort freedom of speech, and in the press as well. They were buying all sorts of views, and there was junkets and money flowing all over the place. And so, in effect,
we had our minister who approved the port sale in Darwin, and then went to work for the same port
exactly
a few months later. For
right next to the you know, the Marines installation there. So, so yes, we were being swept into a new kind of relationship that was much more sort of satrap based. Than what it had been, which was simply an exporter to China. And so why I see the relationship continuing to get worse now is, well, once the Australian people, in effect, the political classes, but most importantly, the people woke up to this, they pretty much gave it the bird.
And actually, it's worth, though, David, just sort of touching as well on the whole this wasn't the first time China had done this type of relationship, but Australia was the first sort of developed democracy where they were really trying it out.
Yes.
Like they've done it in a number of developing countries and countries nearby, where once you've bought your influence, you the politicians there have got less oversight, and so you can demand what you paid for.
Yeah.
And I think there was that was where, you know, Australia with a robust media, or relatively robust media, relative to other countries, and all the factors that, and courts and independence is, it was described by some in the US as, you know, Australia was a tip of the spear in terms of going, well, China's trying it out in Australia and in other countries, but Australia was the focus because Australia's economy was so leveraged and is still so leveraged to China that if it was going to work anywhere, it would be China. It would be Australia. And yes, then if it worked there, then they could sort of start trying to then, you know, use that same influence in other countries around the world.
And we also had a crop of the dodgiest politicians available in developed markets. So it was set.
I'm sure everyone thinks that.
It was set, yes, probably, but I'm pretty sure we're right on this occasion. But anyway, it was touch and go for a couple of years. Like there was a debate that we pushed very strongly in at MB, while it was largely buried elsewhere, but it eventually got up and culminated in some legislation under Malcolm Turnbull, which was very explicitly about bulwarking all of the pillars of Australian democracy, of free speech, of et cetera, to remove this Chinese Communist Party influence, at least its malign effects. And that really triggered the tit for tat that is tit for tat diplomacy and economic coercion and various strategic maneuvering that we've seen ever since, which has just been a non-stop deterioration in the relationship. So it's a structural problem between our two systems. And then you've obviously around that at the same time developed, the huge Trump administration China pushback, which was a big wake-up call for pretty much the whole world. Love or hate Donald Trump. You can see today that the Biden administration's continuity with the Trump administration on China is absolutely seamless. They disagree on everything except China. China is 100% seamless integration between the two parties. And so, then Australia's pushback has become part of that developing Cold War 2.0 circumstance. And so now we're simply in a relationship that's unwinding at a really spectacular rate. So that's the context that matters for iron ore over the long term. And why it matters most is, basically, we see that Cold War 2.0 structure developing globally over time and, in effect, balkanizing the world's trade into a liberal bloc and an illiberal bloc. One of them with US at the head and the other one with China at the head. The liberal bloc will be much larger economically, and there'll be various swing geographies in here that are influenced by both, but in effect those two blocks are going to compete for geopolitical power, and so China simply cannot have a mineral or a commodity input that is so strategic in the wrong block as its supplier, right? This is a massive kind of strategic veto that Australia has over China, where China says it's going to invade Taiwan, or does, and Australia cuts off the iron ore. I mean, which is what would happen. Mm-hmm. Either we'd elect to do it, or the US would simply plonk an aircraft carrier off the Pilbara and it happened anyway. So China can't. This is now a strategic vulnerability for China, and that is the really important point to take out of this geopolitical swing, where China has never before had this incentive to get away from Australia, and now it's essential and it's urgent. Mm. So,
and the other question is why iron ore is so important? So they've already banned wine and all these foodstuffs and things like that. And the issue is largely around it is Australia's largest export. It makes a huge amount of money for the Australian government, and of the major mining stocks, which make up a huge part of the Australian stock market, there's a while notionally Rio and BHP are diversified miners, so much of their profits comes from iron ore that it's you may as well treat them as an iron ore stock rather than as a diversified mineral stock at the moment, at current iron ore prices in particular.
So just one final point to make on the sort of geopolitics of this. The Australian Labor Party has been caught on the wrong side of this horribly and has now doubled down on it, like in bizarrely, I don't know why. Well, I do know why, but it's long and complex. As a result, it's probably unlikely to get elected. Even though the existing government is inept in some very obvious and ballot box killing ways, I think it's very difficult for the ALP to overcome the China issue in Australia now. But even if it does get elected and tries to repair the relationship with China, as it were, it will fail. because at the end of the day, China's declared its hand. It's put out a document with 14 conditions on what we need to do to be friends, and they're effectively the end of democracy in Australia. So it simply is untenable, no matter who's in power. So it will get worse.
Do you think, obviously, they're probably... they know that. So, you know, is it like there's obviously a fair bit of work. They've got to do a purge of some description, or like what's a step?
Who are you saying that knows that?
I don't think the AFP does know. I think that's the problem. I think they're we don't want to go into this too much, but their entire corporate memory, you know, the icons of their culture, Gough Whitlam, etc., you know, the party history, it's all so the modern Australian Labor Party is embedded with China. China is its great success story.
Yeah, right.
It's integral to it, the way it thinks about itself. You know, we opened up China, or Labor helped open up China very early, made, you know, lots of money out of it. The CCP has invested four decades in grooming the ALP, like in a way that it didn't do with the Liberal Party. I mean, it has done both, most definitely. But, you know, the Labor MPs, it was almost a rite of passage for them to head off to China and Shanghai and, you know, meet the people who matter over the years, et cetera, et cetera. And so the greybeards are all kind of embedded in the architecture of this failing structure as well. Many of them have got jobs in it.
Mm-hmm.
So they're protecting their own incomes. Anyway, that's not what this post is about. But
but
they've got a lot of work to do to try and pivot. But even, I guess the main point is, even if they do, I think they'll fail.
Because
it's simply not about political parties anymore. It's about systemic contradiction. So, okay. So the takeout is... over the long run, China's definitely going to move away from Australian iron ore. It's got this strategic compulsion to do so. So we'll come back to that. That's more about the iron ore market structure. So the next step in this presentation is to look at where we are now.
Yep.
So I would say, I guess just to segue into that, I would say the first point is, you know, China obviously wants to get away from Australian oil very fast. It's also very angry at how high the iron ore price is right now, given it's kind of being humiliated by its own trade war.
Mm-hmm.
And so what David means that is they announced a trade war with Australia effectively. We're not going to buy all this stuff. We're going to ban everything. And because of the increases in the prices, the only things they are still bringing in, Australia's as a net export thing, Australia's exports are actually better than they've ever been to China.
Yes, so iron ore is destroying its attempt to coerce Australia because they just need it too much. So at the moment, you know, we have a tight iron ore market, and there are two primary reasons for that. One is, you know, coming out of COVID, you know, China launched a massive credit push. And it was really big. Like, lots of people have said it wasn't that big, but it was. It was really big. Lots of new stimulus money, both into property and infrastructure. And then the peculiar nature of this cycle as well is that unlike a regular recession, you know, stalled activity rebounds quicker out of a pandemic. And so you get this, what we've been calling a pig in the python, where you get both the resumption of projects that were briefly stalled by the virus and the stimulus forms this huge bulb of demand that pushes through like a pig through a python. So it takes a year or so for it to push through, but what it does is give you just a super spike in demand. And that's what we've seen. And if there's a chart on this page on the iron ore cycle where it shows, you know, the lift in Chinese steel output through the first 5 months of this year was just huge. It's like an extra 50 million tons of steel, which is a rate of growth year to year that we've never seen before. Like, it's huge. It's just a huge lift. Now, if you look at this chart, you'll see two things. You see first how big the lift has been, but the second point is it's flattening out quite quickly, and the rate of growth between last year and this year is actually shrinking really fast. So earlier in the year, I think the year-on-year lift was like 16% or something, and now it's at least half that, probably less. So in other words, the pig is pushing through the python, and what we're going to see as the year goes on is Chinese steel growth. The growth in output from last year to this year in steel output is going to keep falling back towards last year. And so I'm expecting by the end of the year, they'll almost be at zero growth. We'll almost be back to next year, last year's output.
So just a quick one for you, Dave. So something that sort of jumps to mind is obviously there's sort of real demand forces on say, commodity prices, and then there's financial derivative demand perhaps as well. So obviously we've seen an enormous amount of stimulus and easing around the world. There's cash is cheap if not free to pretty much anyone in the institutional space. Is there an opportunity for it to exacerbate the demand in terms of higher prices and
create certainly the case. It's difficult to track in iron ore because it's not follow. Like the inventories you can do in base metals and stuff via CFTC are more transparent. In iron ore, you're really looking at port stocks, mill stocks, that kind of thing. And there's no real evidence of hoarding in those. But there are lots of bolt holes for iron ore in China. And it's certainly the case that its futures market is absolutely a wild ball of money and is open these days to foreign money. And there has been a lot of, at night in the Dalian exchange, there's been some very bullish activity. So there's no doubt that there's been some speculative stuff.
And I guess the other thing is iron ore is bulky. So it is harder to store than other commodities.
It is, yeah. So so it's not hoarding so much as it is, I guess, speculating on the futures. Stuff that's been driving it. So, but there's definitely an element of that. But the key is the underlying market has been very tight, and the principal driver of that has been immense Chinese steel output growth over the year. It's been very big,
And there's probably been a little bit as well of extra stocking just from people in China who are worried that there's going to be more conditions put on Australian iron ore and the market might get tighter, so that I'll bring forward some of my demand to make sure I've got enough stock on hand to in case the relationship deteriorates worse.
I'd characterize that as a bit of a geopolitical risk premium, Damien. So I think there's probably 20 bucks, 30 bucks worth of that in the price as well. Certainly in the last 6 weeks as the Australian relationship really deteriorated, that news flow seemed to have a direct impact on price. So I think that is a component. Now, the second half to the tight market, of course, is supply, and that's really just all about Brazil, as it has been since 2019, when the Brumadinho Dam burst. Brazilian supply has been rebounding at a pretty good clip, but it's still down. They're looking at probably 320 million tons this year, and 2018 it was like 400 million. So, that's a very big hit to supply, and that's what, got iron ore up to, well and truly out of its 2015 to 2019 doldrums. And in fact, in 2018-19, China was tightening a lot on credit, and iron ore demand wasn't going terribly well. And I think we would have seen a fair bit of pain in that period for iron ore had the Brumadinho Dam collapse not happened. But it instead drove the price back up over 100 bucks. And that was the base, I guess, from which, the current price spike launched. And it is an integral component to this current tight market. So that's where we are right now, and it's impossible to exactly pinpoint where we are in this demand cycle and the pig and the python thesis, but we're somewhere probably closer to the end than the beginning. There are you know, the slowing of the growth in the steel output is a bit of a giveaway, and there are lots of indicators in China showing falling growth in both real estate and infrastructure.
Dave, I just had a question drop in. Just, we touched on Brazil before, so I think maybe we'll pop it in now if you like. It's from Robin. Thanks, Robin. What's the chance that Americans do us a favour, not that this is ethical, and overthrow the Brazilian government to make sure Vale is in shambles?
Well, I don't know. This is my answer to that one. I don't know.
No, I'd say very, very, very low.
Pretty low.
Look, Brazil's got lots of corruption problems. In terms of senior politicians, has a very Trump-like figure at the moment in charge, who's very close with the military. Mm. I would say the chance of anything happening is very, very low. And I think there's, you know, it's a democracy. You know, you would need a lot. You'd need a significant number of years let's put it another way. There's plenty of other countries nearby where democracy has deteriorated far worse, and you've seen far worse behavior from without a lot of intervention by the US, and you know, Venezuela comes to mind. I think almost zero.
Yeah. So the market balance is currently a bit of a deficit, and so prices are very high. But over the next 6 to 12 months, we basically see it swinging into a big surplus. Now, the leading edge of that is already very obvious in Chinese credit. The tightening, particularly in the commodity-intensive areas, three red lines policy for developers, et cetera, has been really standout and strong. And the current trend for total social financing, which is the one that matters because it brings in a lot of local government bonds and other things that are commodity intensive, on its current trend, it'll basically drop over $1 trillion of new credit this year versus last. Now, there's nothing globally that can compete with this or offset it. Anyone telling you that it will be offset by developed market stimulus is smoking crack. So this is going to drop Chinese demand for iron ore in due course. Hard to be precise, but my best guess is we get to sort of Q3 in the typical September October week period, and you know, that's my penciled in kind of tipping point for it. Might come earlier, might come a bit later, but it's coming. So that's the biggest factor in a shift in the market balance. It should be big enough as well to overwhelm any opening up that's coming from other economies.
Actually, before you get too far into that, David, I just want to hit that the point you're making about the developed market stimulus.
Yep.
So, you know, a lot of this, one of the big groups that sort of does analysis of this is CRU, who basically they're a consultant to mining companies and to governments, and so they tend to be more on the bullish side in terms of you know, they're out there to tell people how much they're going to need, and their estimate for $1 trillion of US stimulus was basically adding about 0.3% to world demand for steel.
Wow.
So it's just $1 trillion of US because of the way the stimulus comes, like roads don't actually use very much steel. Bridges do, but you don't build that many bridges. Mm. And the US has got stacks of recycling. So if you're knocking down a bridge and putting up a new bridge, chances are you're actually using a lot of steel that's there. And similar with buildings. Buildings are where you use most steel, are high-rise buildings. And we're not building that many high-rise buildings. And in the US, when you do, you're generally knocking down some sort of high-rise building as well. So, you've got a lot of steel recycling within the US.
You do. It's nearly all recycled. And most of the estimates I've seen are like ten max million tons of steel additional per annum, which is nothing, and it won't come next year anyway. Like, by the time all of this filters through and you've got to prepare your projects and whatever, that's a 2023 story. Right. So, and I'm really talking about the next 18 months here. So So first, we're going to see a big fall in Chinese demand. There's not going to be anywhere else that's, you know, strong enough to offset it. And on the supply side, we're going to see some resolution for some of these hiccups that have been holding stuff back for the last 2 years. So, you know, Brazil's returning about 20 extra million tons this year, and that's already obvious in the numbers. And it's another 20 next, and then the 20 the year after, roughly speaking. And so it'll be back up, pushing towards its 400 million tons where it used to be. It could be a little bit more, could be a little bit less. They're obviously having these chronic issues with dams, and that popped up again this week. It'll pop up again almost certainly. But, you know, hopefully for the Brazilian people, they don't have any more catastrophic failures. Now, Australia is actually going to be bringing on around a little more than that over the next 2 years as well, largely via Fortescue and Rio. Like, they have roughly 70 million tons of new mines opening up over the next couple of years, various forms, magnetite versus hematite, blah, 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 blah. All you know, a lot of it's designed, you know, to sort of service future iron ore trends and upgrade their products and what have you, but they will increase volumes. So there's some goodly volume coming over the next couple of years as well. Some of it certainly in the next 12 months, we'll see, you know, another 20 or so. And then when you get into the second half of 2022, then there's a lot more coming. So, yeah, it just keeps coming over the next 2 years. And goodness me, if you look at the forecasts for Australia's official forecast of the Office of the Chief Economist, it just keeps on growing over the next 5 years. I think they're smoking crack too in there, quite frankly. Just
forecasting records not true.
Well, it's not. Although it's been better in the last few years. But I just think the price is going to kill off some of those volume expansions before they get here. So, okay, so in short, you know, we're going to see these swings to increase supply incrementally. And I think the 50 million tons of extra steel that's being produced in China this year is going to disappear relatively quickly. Now, you know, that's the cyclical turn that probably halves the iron ore price over 18 months. So that gets you back down to semi-reasonable prices, somewhere around 120 or something.
And to put that in context, though, all of the big suppliers can produce at 30, well, definitely under 50 and profitably, and probably under 30 profitably.
Oh, definitely.
So under 30. There's not
mid-20s.
And there's truckloads of iron ore out there. It's not a rare mineral or anything. The longer term, like if you look at, you know, sort of 150 odd year histories of iron ore, is on a today's dollars price, you know, basis. It sort of gets, in the past, it sort of got up to $50, $60 and then back down to that sort of $30 and then back up to $50, $60. There's only been two real big spikes three. One just before the financial crisis, another one after the financial crisis with China's big stimulus, and then this one now. So even the big sort of entry of Japan and South Korea into the world sort of market and developed market, push the iron ore price up, but to levels that were sort of like $60 or $70. Like, it's like a third of the level of, it could fall, current prices could fall 70% and still be above the prices that, you know, you saw, you know, in previous, because of, in the boom because of Japan. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Right, sure.
Well, at 120, nearly the entire iron ore price curve is still in the black. I mean, there'll be a few mines in China struggling, but not really, because the really high cost stuff was all driven out over the last cycle. So, I mean, you know, iron ore is unbelievably overpriced right now, you know, in terms of its fundamental cost of extraction. So that brings us, that's our short sort of 12 to 18 month time frame. But the biggest story here is actually the long term. And there's, I guess we're harking back to where we started here and the process or decomposition in the Australia-China relationship. And so China's obviously going to do whatever it can over the next 18 months to crash iron ore, and it won't be able to do much, is the truth. Like, it can talk it down and jawbone it a bit and it pull a few strings on the futures markets and other things and do what you were mentioning earlier, Tim, with its strategic reserves and et cetera, et cetera. It'll do all those things and they'll work a little bit at the margin psychologically on the market, but they really can't fix the overpricing. But what it can do long term is definitely fix the overpricing and make Australia pay for it. So how is the question? So the first part of this this question, which we've characterized as iron ore market structure, if you move forward onto your next page and charts, the first key to understanding this is Chinese urbanization, which is the fundamental driver of this entire thing, industry, if you like, is like nearing the end, to put it bluntly. The recent census have pinned urbanization of the population at 64%. Typical continental economies, Europe, the US, top out at 75, three quarters. You do get some higher numbers for smaller, very concentrated populations, you know, up around 80, like Japan or Brazil, I think, are examples of that. But when you get the really big continental economies, the typical number is about 75. So when that still leaves you, you know, 11% more urbanization. But there's a few factors you got to kind of plug into this. First is they did 14% over the last 10 years. So they do that again, they're overshooting by 2030 because they're doing it at a really good clip. Second, there's just massive pre-building for this. So, you know, there's just enormous quantities of empty apartments, there's surplus infrastructure, there's enormous quantities of 95% complete apartments that are never quite completed, and so they're not exactly registering in the numbers, but they're still floating around in there. And, you know, the numbers are very opaque and difficult to follow, but plausibly you could say they stop building today and they'd have enough of everything. Which is why
it's an issue as well. If you rarely approach a stoplight at 100 kilometers an hour. You know, there's a wherever that top out, even if it's in the 80s or you know, or 75. If you've been growing at 1.5%, you've been adding 1.5% urbanization every year. You're unlikely to go 1.5% all the way up and then stop dead, and that's you do zero the year after. Like it's going to start tailing off. It's going to be
mind you. Several examples have done just that. Like Japan basically did that.
Oh, no, but they didn't approach – but their urbanization didn't. They tried – I guess in terms of the building side can. Your building absolutely can. And your spending in terms of capital spending can approach at 100 kilometers an hour and then all of a sudden wonder where all the demand went to.
Yeah.
But the actual number of getting those people to actually move into cities is harder and harder the further up you go.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
That said, some of the other examples didn't have a big rifle to point at everyone.
Well, you had Cuba, Russia as well, went through the same process.
So I think if I was them, I would slow it because I just want to just keep some of this growth, you know, rather than just blow it all up and be left having a real growth cliff. Be that as it may, whatever they choose to do, they're just facing the end of it over the next decade. And so what this means is it's the structural end to the Chinese steel output cycle that we've had for, by the time it's done, it'll be 20, 25 years. It'll start to decline, Chinese steel output. Now, I put a number on that of, say, 3% per annum, just endlessly, and it probably drops structurally by 20%. That's roughly what happened in Japan. But that said, the Chinese steel sector is so immense, maybe more. you know, and the overbuilding is immense, so it may be more, and it's a much, much bigger part of the economy than it was elsewhere, so it may be more. But it will be very big is the important takeout. And we are somewhere getting close to where it's going to start. So you know, that's going to give you, if it's 3% per annum, that's like 50 million tons of iron ore that China won't need each year. There's a few offsets in that with growth elsewhere and what have you. But if that starts to just happen every year for 5 or 6 years, then obviously you're very quickly talking about hundreds of millions of tons of iron ore that you're just simply not going to need.
But it's probably worth noting, Dave, we're not expecting it to be a straight line. Like this will be... No. Like your trend will be down, but in terms of the how it's going to occur, it'll drop away really sharply, and then it'll suddenly come flying back as there's this new push of debt and things, and they're worried about how fast it's slowing down, and then it will fade off again, and then all of a sudden it'll shoot downward and undershoot, and it'll be a
and they could hit the traffic light at 100 miles an hour. They could just go hell for leather on this until there's nothing left to build.
Mm.
So I'm not saying that those. I can't say for sure that steel output is going to fall next year or 2023. Like it's I don't know, but it is coming in the next 5 or so years.
And one more point though as well is in terms of the 100% 100 kilometers an hour. If you wanted to keep doing that, you could keep building, but you got to start knocking down stuff that you built before to do that. And so if you're doing that, you don't need fresh iron ore because you knock down a building, you take the steel out that you did, and then you put it into the you recycle it and put it into the next one.
Yeah. So which brings us to the next dimension of this discussion, which is alternative supply. So there's a structural tipping point that's close for Chinese steel output. But there are also a bunch of possibilities to displace Australian supply, irrespective of that. None of them are short term, but they are there. So the first one that everyone discusses and knows about is Guinean iron ore in Africa and the Simandou project, which has got this new urgency to it. Very difficult project to pull together. But if it's done, say, first phase by 5 years and then second phase by 2030, that's 200 million tons of iron ore that China can own outright. Brazil, as I discussed, can do 2020, but it can keep going. Like it's got options to go right up to 450 by 2025 if it wants to. And then in terms of just these kind of national suppliers, I guess, one of the things that's not terribly well understood right now is India at the moment is just about the swing supplier in the global iron ore market. Like India, without India, which its industrial production's really been suffering under COVID, and so that's filtered down to its steel sector, and it's got a lot of iron ore surplus at the moment, which it would normally keep for itself. It's shipping like 70 million tons annualized rate to China from what was under 10.
A year or two ago.
So it's absorbing a lot of the what would be price gains. I think without India, we'd already be at $300 in iron ore. But that's unlikely to last. So that's going to be some price positive offset over the next year or two.
What is the productive capacity of India, though? It doesn't jump to mind for mine as not one of the iron ore.
Oh, no, it's quite big. No, they've got good output. I couldn't tell you what it is off the top of my head, but they're self-sufficient with some left over for export.
Yep.
Got the second biggest steel output globally, I think. They're quite a big... I mean, there's China, which is, a planet unto itself, but relative to everyone else, India's big.
Yeah, right, okay.
Yeah, substantial. So, but India is prone to kind of nationalist convulsions, especially in things like steel, where it, if India starts to recover and its steel sector, which is very politically connected, it gets upset, then the likelihood is that it will sit on those iron ore exports again. Like 10 years ago, in fact, around the millennium, it was actually Indian iron ore producers that largely opened the Chinese market to exports. And back then it was doing 100, 110 million tons of exports to China. Mm-hmm. And then around 2013, I can't remember exactly, it just cut it off.
Right. And
the steel sector just said, no, we want to keep it. And it went from 100 to almost zero. So that's an upside price risk in terms of alternative supplies, and that could help turn the the shorter term swing to surplus a little more manageable, if you like. But then, you know, so there are these various alternative supplies to Australia, and who knows which ones China is going to tap. And try and develop. As I say, Simandu seems to have momentum, but it is a very difficult and expensive project. And China must look, it knows that the end of its own urbanisation is coming. And so there is a consideration here of do we bother opening up those new channels of iron ore supply when we know our steel output's close to peaking? And then we come to the real threat to iron ore supply, which is actually steel recycling. And China has moved dramatically on this front in the last few months. So you may not necessarily want to open your iron ore mines if you're going to transform your steel sector from basic oxygen blast furnaces to electric arc furnaces, which are all recycled steel.
Yep.
So if you can move forward on the document, you'll see basically China's scrap output has risen over about a decade from roughly 10 or 11% to about 23% today of total output. So it's had pretty decent growth. Mm. But the recent five-year plan explicitly stated that it wants to lift that to 30% by 2025. Now, even if you have stable steel output over that period, that will be a huge blow to iron ore if they pull that off. And they probably will. It's centrally planned, you know. So the difficulty will be finding enough scrap, quite frankly. They will have to...
And it helps a number of... It's not just penalising Australia. It helps hit their climate change... Yes, factors. It's cheaper. It's puts out less carbon. There's a number of other, and there'll be older steel factories that'll be far less efficient as well in terms of just the cost that they can produce at than some of these electric arc ones. That there'll be a number of net benefits to the Chinese economy that, you know, pushing the iron ore price down to spite Australia is helpful, but it won't be like it's not like a main reason to do it. There's other much, much more important reasons to do it anyway.
Absolutely. But it's a great bonus, shall we say.
Exactly. So it's a cherry on the top.
So, you know, there are other forecasts out there that suggests, doubling current scrap output by 2030. Some of these numbers get pretty rubbery and I think that they're too aggressive. It's very, very difficult to find that much scrap that quickly. But I've drawn up a chart here based on my best guess of what's going to happen, and that is that sometime over the next few years, steel output starts to fall, say 3% a year, and scrap continues to grow at its current pace. Mm-hmm. It doesn't accelerate. It actually misses all those five-year plan targets. And dramatically misses doubling by 2030. In fact, on the current growth rate, it would get to, by the end of this decade, like slightly over 30%, like 32, 33, something like that. Close to 30. In that scenario, seaborne iron ore loses 500 million tons of demand in China. Yeah. Yes, that's right. 500 million tons, 500 million tons. Now that's either all of Brazil and India, or it's 2/3 of the Pilbara. by 2030. So, I mean, this gives you some idea of the magnitude of the forces at work here in the structure of the iron ore market as China reaches two things, two interconnected points in its development. One is it's ending urbanization. Part of that is it wants to, as we all know, rebalance towards services and higher value add activity away from traditional construction and building where there's all this misallocated capital. And, if it wants to keep getting richer, it has to do that, as all developed economies have done before it that were successful. If you don't, you stagnate into what is called the middle income trap. And second to that, because it's an autocracy that's based its legitimacy on economic success, that would pose a direct political threat to the Communist Party. So it needs something new to drive its own legitimacy, and that is going to be nationalism. It's already nationalism. That's well underway. We're seeing that in everything Xi Jinping does is nationalistic. Everything from cults of personality to wolf warriors to plotting invasions of Taiwan, building out into the South China Sea, you name it. All of this is part sort of strategic impulse, and part it's about the CCP transforming its legitimacy into a nationalist-based rather than economic base. Mm. It can't do that in the world we've described, where it relies on Australian iron ore that sits in the hostile liberal bloc. Right? It can't make that transformation to nationalism. Can't do anything. Can't invade Taiwan. Australia has this veto over it. So, in short, as that transformation happens and all that iron ore demand disappears, it's going to push it all onto Australia. China is going to push all of that onto Australia. It's just not going to buy the Australian iron ore because it needs to decouple from Australia, and will. So that doesn't mean it means some of the Australian iron ore won't get shipped anymore. But what will happen is that this immense surplus of iron ore that Australia has will go everywhere else. And it will displace everything because a lot of it's very cheap. And so what's left will go to China, and Australia and I will just flood everything, all corners of the universe. And the price is just going to absolutely crater because you've got to clear, half a billion tons of iron ore supply out of the global economy. Coupled with falling volumes that are going to result from China pushing this transformation onto Australia, and our high cost supply will have to come out, the cratering prices, etc. At the moment we're doing some spectacular amount of export revenue to China, annualized it's about 170 billion or something, but that's going to fall to 20 by 2030. So this is a huge hit to Australians' export income. Now it's not fatal by any stretch, and in fact, it will be accompanied by losing a lot of other Chinese demand, in if not all of it, in our various exports. So it's actually a bigger hit even than that. But it basically means the biggest change is the Australian dollar will have to fall a very long way to offset this income hit. And it happens automatically because, when you have this massive income hit, as a result, the budget is pounded, the stock market's pounded, wages all get pounded. All of these things happen, and so your interest rates can't rise, and in fact, they may have to go negative, irrespective of what's happening elsewhere. So we get a carry trade that evaporates, possibly goes into reverse. Anyway, the Australian dollar will just adjust to this automatically. I think it will drop below 50 cents. It's entirely plausible it would drop below 40.
It's
yes and no.
It's a risk case.
That's a risk case. Yeah. Yes. It depends. Yeah. There's no way of knowing these things. Like it could all happen in a rush. It could happen as a drip.
Mm.
You know, there's just no way of knowing. And it could happen partly by crisis, which sinks it for, 6 months into really unimaginable depths. You know, like markets overshoot, So... the bottom line is, though, it's going to sink a long way. Now, the end of this is not going to kill Australia. There's a lot of mining and various interests like to say that everything about us that we do is all based on dirt being worth a lot of money, and it's bullshit. Mm. It's not going to kill us. If iron ore falls to $30 and the Australian dollar falls to a little under 50 cents, and China pulls out its various other volumes, et cetera, well, the net result will be Australian export dollars decline a little because that's the beauty of a floating currency. You know, that's what it's for. It absorbs external shocks.
Yep.
Then the next question that will pop into people's heads is if it's possible that the Australian dollar could fall so far, then could we then, and we're having a big export income shock that's structural and permanent. Could that result in a crisis for Australia, an external crisis? Right now, for many years, many Australian economists have feared that. These days, it's all forgotten because we're running spectacular current account surpluses, in part thanks to the iron ore boom. I certainly think that as this happens, we'd probably revert back to current account deficits. Having negative interest rates and stuff will certainly be, hitting the currency, and we'll see some trade inflation because the currency had fallen so far. But we went through a kind of limited version of this in 2015 when iron ore plunged to $38, and we saw no inflation whatsoever, because at that point the currency fell from $1.10 an awful lot further than even we're contemplating here. Well, no, probably roughly the same, because the fact is that the income shock is very deflationary internally as well, and so you're not going to get wage growth. You'll have rising taxes to offset the hit to the budget. You'll see some very serious damage in the stock market and therefore to wealth. And those things are all deflationary enough that you just don't see a spike in inflation. Tradable inflation just gets absorbed by the local stuff. And so it's unlikely that it would result in any kind of external crisis, because the RBA won't be forced to protect the currency in any way. They can just let it fall until it finds an equilibrium that offsets the income shock. And they could use, if this starts to hit spreads for banks and other things, then they've got QE there to do that as well. So I don't think I used to think this could possibly result in an Australian external shock, but I really don't think it would these days. I think it's manageable.
Yep.
But you want, obviously, as an investor, you want to be on the right side of it.
Mm.
Because there will be dramatic impacts on asset prices.
And opportunities.
Yeah, absolutely. I think high house prices and stuff are likely to suffer a little, but I don't think it would crash. But obviously bond yields will be a really interesting place to be. And then you just don't want to get your stocks wrong. And then the Australian dollar, if it's going to fall as far, isn't it just a fantastic opportunity? And for you, if you're invested, positioned right, and obviously I'm talking about having assets offshore.
Mm.
And the other thing I would say about the dollar is, when you devalue externally, this is one of the reasons why I wouldn't necessarily see a housing crash associated with this, is because if it falls to, say, 45 cents, then Australian housing is devalued immensely versus the rest of the world already.
Yeah.
So this is the wonderful thing about the Australian dollar. the Australian people do not realise what a wonderful thing it is, the Aussie dollar.
And we've said before on this, as an external investor investing in Australia, it acts as an amplifier. So when world economy is going great, Australian stocks go great because they're generally leveraged to that world economy, and the Aussie dollar goes up as well, and so you get the double effect. And then, but vice versa, when nothing turns, you get double downside. From inside looking out, it's actually the opposite effect. So you get it acts as a shock absorber on what's happening elsewhere in the world.
So you imagine a post-China Australia, iron ore is still going out, but in terms of being this key driver of everything, it's history. The Aussie dollar is at, say, 40, 45 cents. And Australia's still highly educated, got rule of law, pack of fuckwits running the joint, but that's okay. rich consumers on the doorstep of Asia, and if you have a dollar down there for long enough, it's going to suck in capital, lots of it, investment from everywhere else.
Yep. A couple of comments here, and feel free for anybody just to finally put in any questions as well of the boys. There's one here from L. Berg. Thank you for your comment. If the Fed raises rates and Australia goes negative, property prices will stay the same, maybe rise, but that Tesla will cost you double. These are more comments, I think, than questions. But anyway,
you can sell it for double if you own it in advance.
As opposed to the stock.
It's the point, though, is that it becomes for Australians sitting within here. Tesla's a bad example because we don't bother making cars anymore. But there's stuff which we do make locally that's import competing, and the people who are making it locally all of a sudden have an advantage over their international competitors. Right. So that's where, which then means that the Australian that's the mechanism that helps the rebound.
Look, I'm not saying most economists will tell you that this process is it's a fall in living standards, right? In part because the people making the best stuff with the competitive advantage around the world will be more expensive, and that's true. But at the end of the day, you have to make a choice between do you want a slightly more expensive Tesla, or do you want to be enslaved?
Spending money.
Or do you want to be enslaved to the CCP? So, to me, it's a no-brainer of an answer. And at the end of the day, as I said before, there will be tradable inflation, but what's always happened before is that the producers just tend to absorb it in margins.
Yep.
A lot of it.
Question here from Jude. How do you guys know all this information? What do you read and where do you synthesize it all? There's someone who's offered a book, Disunited Nations by Peter Zeehan, as something that they've Robin's recommended. But if you're interested to hear you guys, of course, you can follow it all at Macro Business.
I like Peter Zeehan. I think he's good fun. We're economists and investors, and we track the data and formulate our own views, as well as reading everyone else's. But in truth, on this subject, we're probably there with the world expert.
Well, and the other thing Dave used to be was the managing editor founding editor was for The Diplomat. Dave?
The Diplomat magazine around that. Founded it for 10 years. That was like, Australia's version of sort of foreign affairs or foreign policy, was global economy and geopolitics. Sold that in 2007. It's now like the biggest portal of its kind right across Asia. The new owner did a great job of taking it online and developing it into an Asian, not just Australian product. So I've just been steeped in this stuff for as long as we can remember. Iron ore has just been so central to everything Australian for so long that it's actually quite convenient. not many economies have this kind of singular dependence that you can analyze in detail and know that the implications are so big.
Mm.
And so it's narrow enough for one person to cover. But, you know, we just do our due diligence. It's that simple.
But yeah, no, but I think as well from you know, Australia's perspective, you know, I think it was sort of post just pre the financial crisis. You know, I was looking, we're sort of as stock market analysts sort of talking around people in the whole strategy team and just saying, you know, what, you know, how are we getting? Where's our competitive advantage going forward? And what do we need to know for the, you know, for the upcoming for the years? And really the the acknowledgement about how dramatically Australia had changed with the pivot to how much it was now exporting to China and how dependent we'd become upon that Chinese economy sort of very much was the light bulb that went off to say, actually, you don't know much about China right now. You know, there's, you need to find out what's going on, and you need to start paying attention to Chinese statistical analysis, and so it's very easy to you know, in the early 2000s it was all about the US. What's the US doing? What's the US consumer doing? Because we know that'll flow on, and that'll, you know, if there's booms going on in the US or you know, didn't often get booms in Europe, but you know, you're getting booms going on in the US, and that's going to spread to commodity markets, and that's what's going to drive it. Whereas that completely changed in the sort of mid 2000s, and it's been true for Australia ever since then, is that, you know, the key thing is no longer what the US consumer is doing. It's now what the Chinese home builder is doing or infrastructure builder.
Mm. Yeah, yep. Like if you've been exposed to this for long enough, it's all been pretty obvious for a long time.
Mm.
Like I visited Shanghai in, I think, 2002, you know, nearly 20 years ago, and the Chinese model was in its infancy then. Like it was being deployed in Shanghai as an experiment. That's its urbanization model. And even then it was obvious, several things were obvious. One, it was succeeding. Two, they were going to do it everywhere, like across China. It wasn't just going to be Shanghai.
Mm.
They were going to rebuild the entire joint. And three, At that point in time, it was all, you know, the Western rhetoric and discourse was all about how this process was going to liberalize China. But if you visited and saw the sheer magnitude of what was going on, and I can't, it's actually beyond words. I came back from Shanghai with my worldview completely changed in this way. I totally stopped believing that we would change China. And I immediately realized that China would do whatever the hell it wanted.
Mm.
And it would change us instead, because the scale of it was beyond words. I was working in North Sydney at the time amid maybe a dozen high-rise buildings. And, you know, and Shanghai was this building site. Oh, it's hard to describe how immense it was.
Yeah. But I mean, if you look through the buildings, we're doing it as part of our, you know, analysis of steel. You look at the top 100 cities, or top 20, 30 cities, say, for with buildings over 100 meters, and I think at least 50-60% of them are cities in China. And by the time you're sort of getting down to levels where, say, Melbourne or Sydney are at, you're seeing Chinese cities you've just never heard of that have just, you know, have got populations bigger than Australia and with more building.
Absolute backwaters. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So anyway, it's just been a long term, a lot of observation, a lot of research, a lot of experience, you know, all adds up into, I guess, what you would call judgment.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Great. We've got a couple more questions. I might ask for a slightly more abbreviated answers for these ones, just in the interest of time, gentlemen. But Australia's lack of iron ore will end when China gets the African mine going in 2 years. Current government short-sighted addiction to coal and gas is ruining our future jobs and options. Why? From not environmental.
Why are they doing it? Because their power rests on a very small number of Queensland coal seats.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep. No more complex than that.
All right. Very good. Nice, short and sweet.
I say also these guys have a fair bit of money. They can donate to political parties as well.
Well, yes. Yes.
Cogs well oiled. Yes. 40-cent dollar equals Argentina. We can forget democracy as the rest of the farm will be sold. Who will now own it? Says Grouch and Globe.
No, rubbish.
No point. No.
You don't. Well, you know, at 40 cents, 30 cents, it doesn't matter. As long as you don't have an inflation problem, let it go, and you'll end up, yes, you'll have lots of foreign capital coming in that may be buying some stuff, but it'll be buying stuff, but it'll also be investing and building and stuff. But at the same time, we'll be rebuilding our import competitors and our exporters with local capital, you know. Mm. So, you know, it's all swings and roundabouts. And
more money, that's the main thing.
I'm not saying it doesn't have its problems, and if we end up with a lot more, say, American capital, that would come with its own challenges. You know, one of the issues is certainly going to be, as this kind of Cold War 2.0 thing develops, is how not to be bullied by the US. Mm. Now, right now, we're doing a great job, well, sort of a great job in outcomes terms of pushing China back. But there will be points at which we'll be at risk of being bullied by the US as well. And one of them might be too much US capital if the dollar's that low. but no, we won't be Argentina.
Okay. All right. Sure.
Well, and there's always tax. If the stuff's here, there's always tax things you can do to.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. Sure. Last one from Andrew. Thanks, Andrew. If China takes over Taiwan without an international war, what are the odds that they might attack Australia next?
Well,
next, I'd say very low.
Plenty
of other places.
Yes, very, very low next. No, I think China's determined to divorce Australia, not attack it.
Yeah.
I think when push comes to shove, which I don't see as imminent, iron ore being one reason why, and China does annex Taiwan, and it is forcible, then I don't think we should fight that war, because, you know, just about every modelling of it we lose, because, you know, the Chinese mainland just has such a gigantic advantage in fighting it, because it's just sitting right there. What I'd be doing now, and what is happening, and what I hope continues to happen, is that this whole kind of structure of a liberal anti-Chinese bloc continues to develop, and it makes clear that if China does invade Taiwan, then that's the end of it in the global economy.
Mm.
And this is where we come back to the continuity between Biden and Trump. There are legislative moves afoot to constrain things like US capital going into China. They've been mucking around at the fringes, but there are moves afoot to make it much deeper. You know, if they cut the flow of US capital off from China, like, that'd be calamitous for China. You know, mm-hmm. if the major financial centers of the world stop buying Chinese debt, you know, it's all over by the shouting. Now, you have to get Europe involved in that as well. excuse me, and that's what Biden's trying to do. And so that is what I'd do. I'd just make it clear that if you invade Taiwan, you will be blockaded worldwide.
Mm, yep.
Capital, commodities, imports and exports.
Okay. You
know? Yep. I mean, I'm not saying it'd be fun for everyone, but if you made it clear to China that was the outcome, enough. Right? You're never going to do it perfectly, and they're not going to do it. Because it would be catastrophic for their economy, and as a result, you know, they jeopardize their own well-being. Remember, everything that happens in China is about the well-being, not of the Chinese people, but of the CCP.
Mm. Very good. I've got one more that I just want to drop in as well from Ahmed. Has Australia got a case of Dutch disease with regards to its over-reliance on iron ore exports? Is the overpriced domestic housing a symptom of this? And this is going to be the last question. So,
Well, we don't have Dutch disease. We have Australian disease, which is the malignant form of Dutch disease.
Right.
Dutch disease was a very brief problem when the Netherlands discovered some oil, I think, or gas, I can't remember which one, and for a few years its currency rose and its industrial production fell with a higher currency. It lasted maybe 5 years or something. I mean, describing us versus that is preposterous.
Mm.
You know, they had a cold, we have COVID, the COVID version of Dutch disease, right? It's decades old. Our hollowing out is immense.
Yep.
Our high house prices are a figment of Dutch disease. Look, we have sort of a double Dutch disease where we hollowed out our industrial base and we offset that for our cities by the rise of services sectors that were largely driven by offshore borrowing by our banks that was channeled into houses and so wealth effects, consumption, etc. But that also drove up the currency, and so you end up hollowing out even more, and so you end up with double Dutch disease.
Double Dutch.
Yeah. Look, the high house prices are a figment of policy failure rather than necessarily the result of Dutch disease.
No, and they're also there's been a global push as interest rates have fallen around the world, as financialization of world economies, where it's been easier to get loans and more loans. It's not just that. There's also other much bigger factors at play that have been pushing house prices.
Yes.
As well.
Yes, there are.
Fair enough. All right. Thanks, gents. Thanks for a terrific show. We've gone a bit over time. It was a big topic as always, and there's going to be plenty more to say on it, I'm sure. So thanks again for your time. We'll look forward to updating everybody, I guess, on what's going to be a continuing theme. So thanks. Thanks, Damien. Thanks, David.
Pleasure.
All good. And, of course, thanks again to all of those of you, of course, who've watched in for another great episode. And, of course, all of those who asked questions and gave some comments are terrific today. I hope you've taken away some great ideas. And if you haven't already, feel free to click like on the video now to give us some feedback. If you'd like to see more of our content, head over to nucleuswealth.com/content to stay up to date on news from us. Follow us on social media. And finally, if you know anyone who'd get something out of today's episode, let them know about it. Share with a friend and help our show grow. So thanks again for tuning in from myself, Tim Fuller, and the team. And we look forward to catching you with the next one. Cheers.